She could hear faint, soft drips, both nearby and farther away. After time beyond measure, they joined into pillars and walls and draperies that shaped the inside of the cave. There were tiny scrabblings and chitterings of minute creatures and an almost undetectable movement of air, a muted soughing that she had to strain to perceive. It was almost drowned out by the noise of the breathing of the five living beings who had entered the silent space. She tried to smell the air and opened her mouth to sample it. It felt moist, with a slight decaying taste of raw earth and ancient seashells compressed into limestone. After their meal, Zelandani said, "There is something I'd like you to see in this small tunnel. We can leave the packs here and pick them up on the way back, but each of us should carry a lamp." They all found a private corner to pass water and relieve themselves first. Ayla held the baby out to let her pass her wastes as well and cleaned her with some soft, fresh moss she had brought with her. Then she used the carrying blanket to hold Janela on her hip, picked up one of the limestone lamps, and followed Zelandani into the passageway that split off toward the left. The woman started singing again. Both Ayla and Jandalar were becoming familiar with the echoing timbre of the tone that informed them they were near a sacred site, a place that was closer to the other world. When Zelandani stopped, she was looking at the right wall. They followed her gaze and saw two mammoths facing each other. Ayla thought they were particularly remarkable and wondered what all the different placements of mammoths in this cave meant. Since they were created so long ago that no one knew who made them, or even the cave or the people to whom the artists belonged, it wasn't likely that anyone would know, but she couldn't resist asking. "Do you know why the mammoths are facing each other, Zelandani?"
"Some people think they are fighting," the woman said. "What do you think?"
"I don't think so," Ayla said.
"Why not?" the first said.
"They don't look fierce or angry. They seem to be having a meeting," Ayla said.
"What do you think, Jandalar?"
Zelandani asked. "I don't think they're fighting or planning to fight," he said. "Maybe they just happen to meet."
"Do you think whoever put them there would go to the trouble if they just happened to meet?" the first asked.
"No, probably not," he said.
"Maybe each mammoth represents the leader of a group of people who are coming together to make a decision about something important," Ayla said. "Or perhaps they have made the decision and this commemorates it."
"That's one of the more interesting ideas I've heard," Zelandani said.
"But we'll never know for sure, will we?" Jandalar said.
"No, not likely,"
the one who was first said.
"But the guesses people make often tell us something about the one doing the guessing."
They waited together in silence. Then Ayla had an urge to touch the wall between the mammoths. She reached out with her right hand and placed it palm down on the stone, then closed her eyes and held it there. She felt the hardness of the rock, the cold, rather damp sensation of the limestone, and then she thought she felt something else, like an intensity, a concentration, heat. Maybe it was her own body heat warming the stone. She took her hand down and looked at it, then shifted her baby into a slightly different position. They went back to the main passageway and headed north, with lamps for light now instead of torches. Zelandani continued using her voice, sometimes humming, sometimes expressing greater tonal qualities, stopping when she thought there was something she wanted them to see. Ayla was particularly fascinated by the mammoth that had lines indicating fur hanging below, but that also had marks, perhaps bear claw marks scratching through it. She was intrigued by the rhinoceroses. When they got to a place where the song in the large cave grew more resonant, Zelandani stopped again.
"We have a choice here of which way to go," she said. "I think we should go straight first, then turn around and come back to here and take the left passage for a while. then turn around and go back the way we've come and out of the cave. Or we can just take the left way and then return.
I think you should decide, Ayla said.
I think Ayla's right. You have a better sense of the distance, and you know how tired you are.
I am a little tired, but I may never come here again, Zelandani said, and tomorrow I can rest, either in camp or with a horse dragging me on that seat thing you made. We'll go straight ahead until we find the next place that could lead us closer to the mother's sacred underworld.
I think this whole cave is close to her underworld, Ayla said,
feeling a tingling sensation in the hand that had touched stone. You are right, of course, which is why it's more difficult to find the special places, the first said.
I think this cave could take us all the way to the other world, even if it's in the middle of the earth, Jondalar said.
It is true that this cave is much larger, and there is much more to see than we will in this one day. We won't go into the caves below at all, Zelandani said.
Has anyone ever gotten lost in here? Jondalar said. I should think it would be easy enough.
I don't know. Whenever we come here, we always make sure we have someone with us who is familiar with the cave and knows the way, she said. Speaking of familiar, I think this is where we usually replenish the fuel in the lamps. Jondalar got out the fat again, and after the woman added some to the stone bowls, she checked the wicks and pulled them out of the oil and up a little higher, making them burn brighter. Before they started out again, she said, "It helps to find which way to go if you can make sounds that resonate, that make a sort of echo. Some people use flutes, so I think your bird whistling should work, Ayla. Why don't you try it?" Ayla felt a little shy about it and wasn't sure which bird to choose. Finally, she decided on a skylark and thought about the bird with its dark wings and long tail framed in white with bold streaks on its breast and a small crest on its head. Skylarks walked rather than hopped and roosted on the ground in well-hidden nests made of grass. When flushed out, a skylark warbled a rather liquid chirrup, but its early morning song was sustained for a long time as it flew high up in the sky. That was the sound she produced. In the absolute dark of the deep cave, her perfect rendering of the song of a skylark had an eerie incongruity, a strangely inappropriate, haunting quality that caused Jondalar to jerk with a shudder. Zelandani tried to hide it, but she also felt an unexpected quiver. Wolf felt it too, and didn't even try to hide it. His astonishing howl of wolf song reverberated throughout the massive enclosed space, and that set Jon-Ayla off. She began to cry, but Ayla soon understood it wasn't so much a cry of fear or distress as a loud wail that sounded like an accompaniment to wolf. "I knew he belonged to the Zelandania," the first said, then decided to join in with her rich operatic voice. Jondalar just stood there, astonished. When the sounds ended, he laughed rather tentatively, but then Zelandani also laughed, which brought out his hearty, animated laughter that Ayla loved and caused her to join in. "I don't think this cave has heard so much noise in a long time," said the one who was first. "It should please the mother."
As they started out again, Ayla displayed a virtuosity of bird calls, and before very long, she thought she detected a change in the resonance. She stopped to look at the walls, first right, then on the left, and saw a frieze of three rhinoceroses. The animals were only outlined in black, but the figures contained a sense of volume and an accuracy of contour that made them remarkably realistic. It was the same with the animals that were engraved. Some of the animals she had seen, especially the mammoths, were drawn with just an outline of the head and the distinctive shape of the back. Some added two curved lines for tusks. Others were remarkably complete, showing eyes and a suggestion of their woolly coats,
But even without the tusks and other additions, the outlines were sufficient to display the sense of the complete animal. The drawings made her wonder if the quality of her whistles and Zelandani's songs had really changed in certain regions of the cave, and if some ancestor had heard or felt the same qualities there and marked them with mammoths and rhinos and other things. It was fascinating to imagine that the cave itself told people where it should be marked. Or was it the mother who was telling her children through the medium of the cave where to look and where to mark? It made her wonder if the sounds they made really led them to places that were closer to the mother's underworld. It seemed that they did, but in a small corner of her mind she had reservations and only wondered. As they set out again, Ayla continued her bird whistles. Somewhat farther along, she wasn't sure, but felt almost compelled to stop. She didn't see anything at first, but after taking a few more steps, she looked on the left side of the broad cave. There she saw a rather remarkable engraved mammoth. It must have been in its full shaggy winter coat. It showed the hair on its forehead, around the eyes and on the face, and down the trunk.
"He looks like a wise old man," Ayla said.
"He's called the Old One," Zelandani said, "or sometimes the Wise Old One."
"He does make me think of an old man who can claim many children to his hearth, and their children, and perhaps theirs," Jandalar said.
Zelandani started singing again, returning to the opposite wall, and came to more mammoths, many of them painted in black.
"Can you use the counting words and tell me how many mammoths you see?" she said to both Jandalar and Ayla.
They both walked close to the cave wall, holding out their lamps to see better, and made a game of counting out the number word for each one they saw.
"Some are facing left and others facing right," Jandalar said, "and there are two in the middle, facing each other again."
"It looks like those two leaders that we saw before have met again and brought some of their herd with them," Ayla said. "I count 11 of them."
"That's what I got, too," Jandalar said.
"That's what most people count," Zelandani said. "There are a few more animals to see if we continue this way, but they are much farther on, and I don't think we need to visit them this time. Let's go back and take that other passage. I think you'll be quite surprised." They returned to the place where the two tunnels diverged, and Zelandani led them into the other one. She hummed or sang softly as they went. They passed by more animals, mostly mammoths, but also a bison, perhaps a lion, Ayla thought, and she noticed more finger markings, some in distinctive shapes, others seemed more random. Suddenly the first raised the tone and timbre of her voice and slowed her steps. Then she began the familiar words of the mother's song.
"Out of the darkness, the chaos of time, the whirlwind gave birth to the mother sublime. She woke to herself, knowing life had great worth. The dark, empty void grieved the great mother earth. The mother was lonely. She was the only. From the dust of her birth she created the other, a pale, shining friend, a companion, a brother. They grew up together, learned to love and to care, and when she was ready they decided to pair. Around her he'd hover, her pale, shining lover." Her full, rich voice seemed to fill the entire space and depth of the great cave. Ayla was so moved. She not only felt shivers, she felt her throat constricting and tears forming. The dark, empty void and the vast, barren earth, with anticipation awaited the birth. Life drank from her blood. It breathed from her bones. It split her skin open and sundered her stones. The mother was giving. Another was living. Her gushing birth waters filled rivers and seas and flooded the land, giving rise to the trees. From each precious drop new grass and leaves grew,
and lush, verdant plants made all the earth new. Her waters were flowing. New green was growing. In violent labor, spewing fire and strife, she struggled in pain to give birth to new life. Her dried, clotted blood turned to red-ochred soil, but the radiant child made it all worth the toil. The mother's great joy, a bright, shining boy. Mountains rose up, spouting flames from their crests. She nurtured her son from her mountainous breasts. He suckled so hard, the sparks flew so high, the mother's hot milk laid a path through the sky. His life had begun. She nourished her son. He laughed and he played and he grew big and bright. He lit up the darkness, the mother's delight. She lavished her love. He grew bright and strong. But soon he matured, not a child for long. Her son was near grown. His mind was his own. The deep cave seemed to be singing back to the one who was first, the rounded shapes and sharp angles of the stone causing slight delays and altering tones so that the sound coming back to their ears was a fugue of strangely beautiful harmony. For all that her full-bodied voice filled the space with sound, there was something comforting about it to Ayla. She didn't hear every word, every sound. Some verses just made her think more deeply about the meaning, but she had the feeling that if she was ever lost, she could hear that voice from almost anywhere. She watched John Ayla, who seemed to be listening hard, too. John Dalar and Wolf both seemed to be as enraptured by the sound as she was. As the singing continued, Ayla was lulled into feeling the story, but not really hearing every word, until Zelandani came to the verse that Ayla loved best. The great mother lived with the pain in her heart that she and her son were forever apart. She ached for the child that had been denied, so she quickened once more from the life force inside. She was not reconciled to the loss of her child. Ayla always cried at this part. She knew what it was like to lose a son, and felt as one with the great mother. Like Donnie, she also had a son who still lived, but from whom she would be forever apart. She hugged John Ayla to her. She was grateful for her new child, but she would always miss her first one. With a thunderous roar, her stones split asunder, and from the great cave that opened deep under, she birthed once again from her cavernous room and brought forth the children of earth from her womb. From the mother forlorn, more children were born. Each child was different. Some were large and some small. Some could walk and some fly. Some could swim and some crawl. But each form was perfect, each spirit complete, each one was a model whose shape could repeat. The mother was willing. The green earth was filling. All the birds and the fish and the animals born would not leave the mother this time to mourn. Each kind would live near the place of its birth and share the expanse of the great mother earth. Close to her they would stay. They could not run away. Both Ayla and John Dalar looked around the great cavern and caught each other's eye. This was certainly a sacred place. They had never been in such a huge cave, and suddenly they both understood the meaning of the sacred origin story better. There might be others, but this had to be one of the places from which Donnie gave birth. They felt they were in the womb of the earth. They all were her children. They filled her with pride. But they used up the life force she carried inside. She had enough left for a last innovation, a child who'd remember who made the creation, a child who'd respect and learn to protect. First woman was born full-grown and alive, and given the gifts she would need to survive. Life was the first gift, and like Mother Earth, she woke to herself knowing life had great worth, first woman defined, the first of her kind. Next was the gift of perception, of learning, the desire to know, the gift of discerning, first woman was given the knowledge within that would help her to live and pass on to her kin. First woman would know how to learn, how to grow. Her life force near gone, the mother was spent. To pass on life's spirit had been her intent. She caused all of her children to create life anew, and woman was blessed to bring forth life too. But woman was lonely. She was the only. The mother remembered her own loneliness, the love of her friend and his hovering caress with the last spark remaining. Her labor began to share life with woman. She created first man. Again she was giving. One more was living. Both Zelandani and Ayla looked at Jandalar and smiled, and their thoughts were similar. They both felt that he was a perfect example. He could have been first man, and they were both grateful that Dani had created man to share life with woman. From their expressions, Jandalar could almost guess their thoughts and felt a little embarrassed, though he didn't know why he should. To woman and man, the mother gave birth, and then for their home, she gave them the earth. The water, the land, and all her creation. To use them with care was their obligation. It was their home to use, but not to abuse. For the children of Earth, the mother provided the gifts to survive, and then she decided to give them the gift of pleasure and sharing that honors the mother with the joy of their pairing. The gifts are well earned when the honors returned. The mother was pleased with the pair she created. She taught them to love and to care when they mated. She made them desire to join with each other. The gift of their pleasures came from the mother. Before she was through, her children loved too. Earth's children were blessed. The mother could rest. As she always did when she heard the mother's song, Ayla wondered why there were two lines at end. It felt like something was missing, but maybe Zelandani was right. It was just to give it finality. Just before the woman finished her song, Wolf felt the need to respond in the way wolves always communicated with each other. While the first continued her singing, he sang his wolf song, yipping a few times, then making a great, loud, eerie, full-throated howl, followed by a second and a third. The resonances in the cave made it sound that wolves from a great distance were howling back, perhaps from another world. And then John Ayla started her wailing cry that Ayla had come to understand was her way of responding to wolf song. In her mind, Zelandani thought, whether Ayla wants it or not, it seems that her daughter is destined to become part of the Zelandania. Chapter 15. As the first continued into the cave, she held her lamp high. For the first time, they began to see a ceiling. As they neared the end of the passage, they entered an area where the ceiling was so low, Jandalar's head almost brushed it. The surface was almost, but not quite, level and very light-colored. But more than that, it was covered with paintings of animals in black outline. There were mammoths, of course, some almost completely drawn, including their shaggy fur and tusks, and some showing just the distinctive shape of their backs. There were also several horses, one quite large, that dominated its space, many bison, wild goats, and goat antelopes, and a couple of rhinoceroses. There was no order to their placement or size. They faced all directions, and many were painted on top of others, as though they were falling out of the ceiling at random. Ayla and Jandalar walked around, attempting to see it all and trying to make sense of it. Ayla reached up and brushed her fingertips across the painted ceiling. Her fingers tingled at the uniform roughness of the stone. She looked up and tried to take in the entire ceiling, the way a woman of the clan learned to see an entire scene with a quick glance. Then she closed her eyes. As she moved her hand across the rough ceiling, the stone seemed to disappear. She felt nothing but empty space. In her mind, a picture was forming of real animals in that space, coming from a long distance, coming from the spirit world behind the stone ceiling and falling to the earth. The ones that were larger or more finished had almost reached the world she walked in. The ones that were smaller or barely suggested were still on their way. Finally, she opened her eyes, but looking up made her dizzy. She lowered her lamp and looked down at the damp floor of the cave.
"It's overwhelming," Jandalar said.
"Yes, it is,"
Zelandani said.
"I didn't know this was here," he said. "No one talks about it."
"The Zelandania are the only ones who come here, I think. There's a little concern that youngsters might try to look for this and lose their way,"
the first said. "You know how children love to explore caves. As you noticed, this cave would be very easy to get lost in. But some children have been here. In those passages we passed on the right near the entrance, there are some finger marks made by children, and someone lifted at least one child up to mark the ceiling with fingers."
"Are we going any farther?"
Jandalar asked. "No, from here we'll head back," Zelandani said. "But we can rest here for a while first, and while we're here, I think we should fill the lamps again. We have a long way to go."
Ayla nursed her baby a little, while Jandalar and Zelandani filled the lamps with more fuel. Then, after a last look, they turned around and began to retrace their steps. Ayla tried to look for the animals they had seen painted and engraved on the walls along the way, but Zelandani was not constantly singing, and she wasn't making her bird calls, and she was sure she missed some. They reached the junction where the large passage they were in reached the main one and continued south. It was quite a long walk, it seemed, before they reached the place where they had stopped to eat and then turned into the place of the two mammoths facing each other.
"Do you want to stop here to rest and have a bite to eat, or go around the sharp bend first?"
the first asked.
"I'd rather make the turn first," Jandalar said. "But if you are tired, we can stop here. How do you feel, Ayla?"
"I can stop or I can go on. Whatever you want, Zelandani," she said. "I am getting tired. But I think I'd like to get past that sinkhole at the turn before we stop," she said. "It will be harder for me to get going once I stop, until I get my legs used to moving again. I'd like to have that hard part past me," the woman said.
Ayla had noticed that Wolf was staying closer to them on the way back, and he was panting a little. Even he was getting tired, and Janela was more restless. She had probably done her share of sleeping, but it was still dark, and it confused her. Ayla shifted her from her back to her hip, then to the front to let her nurse a while, then back to her hip. Her haversack was getting heavy on her shoulder, and she wanted to shift it to the other, but it would mean changing everything else around, too, and that would be difficult while they were moving. They worked their way carefully around the turn, especially after Ayla slipped a little on the wet clay, and then Zelandani slipped, too. After they made it around the difficult corner, with little effort they reached the turnoff that had been on their right and was now on their left, and Zelandani stopped.
"If you recall," she said, "I told you there is an interesting sacred space down that tunnel. You can go in and see it if you want. I'll wait here and rest. Ayla can use her bird whistle to find it, I'm sure."
"I don't think I want to," Ayla said. "We've seen so much. I doubt that I could appreciate anything new. You said that you may not come back here again, but if you've been here several times before, I think it's likely I may come back again, especially since it's so close to the ninth cave. I'd rather see it with fresh eyes, when I'm not so tired."
"I think that's a wise decision, Ayla," the first said. "I will tell you it's another ceiling, but on this one the mammoths are painted in red. It will be better to see it with fresh eyes. But I do think we should have a bite to eat, and I need to pass water."
Jandalar breathed a sigh of relief, took off his back frame and found a darkened corner for himself. He had been sipping on his small water bag all day, and he felt a need to relieve himself, too. He would have gone in the new passage if the women had wanted to go, he thought, as he stood hearing his stream on the stone, but he was tired of the marvelous sights of this cave for now, and tired of walking, and just wanted to get out. He didn't even care if they ate right now. There was a small cup of cold soup waiting for him, and a bone with some meat on it. Wolf was working his way through a small pile of cut-up meat, too.
"I think we can chew on the meat as we walk," Ayla said. "But save the bones for Wolf. I'm sure he'd like to gnaw on them while he's resting by a fire."
"We'd all like a fireplace about now," Zelandani said. "I think we should also put the lamps away when they run out of fat and use these torches for the rest of the way out."
She had a fresh torch ready for each of them. Jandalar was the first to light his as they walked by the other passage opening out on their left, across from the first painted mammoth they had seen.
"This is the place where you turn in to see the children's finger marks, and there are other kinds of interesting things on the walls and ceilings deep in that passageway, and its several turnoffs," Zelandani commented. "No one knows what they mean, though many have made guesses. Many are painted in red, but it's a bit of a walk from here."
Not long afterward, both Ayla and Zelandani lit their torches. Ahead, where the tunnel split, they took the right-hand path, and Ayla thought she could see the hint of light ahead. When it angled farther to the right, she was sure. But it wasn't bright light, and when they finally walked out of the cave, the sun was setting. They had spent the entire day walking in the great cavern. Jandalar stacked wood in the pit to light with his torch. Ayla dropped her haversack on the ground near the fire pit and whistled for the horses. She heard a distant whinny and started in that direction.
"Leave the baby with me," Zelandani said. "You've been carrying her all day. You both need a rest."
Ayla put the blanket down on the grass and put Janela on it. She seemed glad to kick her feet in freedom as her mother whistled again and ran toward the answering sounds of horses. She always worried when she was gone from them for some time. They slept late the next morning and didn't feel any particular rush to continue their travels, but by mid-morning they were getting restless and anxious to go. Jandalar and Zelandani discussed what would be the best way to get to the fifth cave.
"It's east of here, maybe 2 days' travel, or three if we take our time. I think if we just headed in that direction, we'd get there," Jandalar said.
"That's true, but I think we're also a little north, and if we just go east, we'll have to cross both North River and the river," Zelandani said.
She picked up a stick and started drawing lines on the ground where it was bare.
"If we start out going east but somewhat south, we can reach summer camp of the 29th cave before nightfall and stay with them tonight. North River joins the river near south face of the 29th cave. We can cross the river at the ford between summer camp and south face and have only one river to cross. The river is bigger there, but shallow. And then we can go on toward Reflection Rock and to the fifth cave, the way we did last year."
Jandalar studied her scratchings on the ground, and while he was looking at them, Zelandani added another comment.
"The trail is fairly well blazed on the trees between here and summer camp, and there's a path on the ground the rest of the way."
Jandalar realized that he had been thinking about traveling the way he and Ayla did on their journey, on horseback, with the bowl boat attached to the end of the travois to float their things across streams. They didn't need to concern themselves much about crossing any but the biggest of rivers. But with the first sitting on the pole drag Winnie was pulling, it wasn't likely to float, and neither was the one Racer was dragging with all their supplies. Besides, it would be easier to find their way with blazed trails.
You are right, Zelandani, he said. It might not be quite as direct, but your way would make it easier and likely get us there just as fast or faster.
The trailblazers weren't quite as easy to follow as the first had remembered. It seemed that people hadn't been that way very often lately, but they renewed some of them as they went along, so the trail would be easier for the next person to use. It was nearing sunset when they reached the home of Summer Camp, also known as the West Holding of the 29th Cave, which was sometimes known as Three Rocks, meaning three separate locations. The 29th Cave had a particularly interesting and complex social arrangement. They once had been three separate caves that lived in three different shelters that looked out on the same rich expanse of grassland. Reflection Rock faced north, which would have been a major disadvantage, except that what it had to offer more than compensated for its north face. It was a huge cliff, a half mile long, 260 feet high, with five levels of shelters and a vast potential for observing the surrounding landscape and the animals that migrated through it. And it was a spectacular sight that most people looked upon with awe. The cave called South Face was just that, a two-story shelter facing south, situated to get the best of the sunlight in summer and winter, high enough up to get a good view of the open plain. The final cave was Summer Camp, which was on the west end of the plain and offered, among other things, a wealth of hazelnuts where many of the people from the other caves went to pick in late summer. It was also the one with the closest proximity to a small, sacred cave, which was called by the people who lived in the vicinity simply Forest Hollow. Since all three caves utilized essentially the same hunting and gathering areas, hard feelings were developing, leading to fights. It wasn't that the area couldn't support all three groups. It was not only rich in itself, it was a major migration route, but often two or more gathering groups or hunting parties from different caves went after the same things at the same time. Two uncoordinated hunts, trying for the same migrating small herd, interfered with the plans of both and had been known to chase away the animals with neither group getting a kill. If all three groups went after them independently, it was worse. All the Zelandani caves in the region were being pulled into the disagreements, one way or another, and finally, at the urging of all their neighbors, and after difficult negotiations, the three separate caves decided to join together and become one cave in three locations, and work together to mutually harvest the plenty of their rich plain. Though there were still occasional differences, the unusual arrangement seemed to be working. Because the summer meeting was still going on, not many people were at the West Holding of the 29th Cave. Most of those who stayed back were old or sick and unable to make the trip, plus the ones who stayed to care for them. In rare cases, someone who was working on something that couldn't be interrupted or could only be done in summer also stayed. Those who were at West Holding welcomed the travelers enthusiastically. They seldom had visitors this early in the summer, and since they were coming from the summer meeting, they could bring news. In addition, the visitors themselves made news wherever they went. Jondalar, the returned traveler, and his foreign woman and her baby, and the wolf and horses, and the first among those who served the Great Earth Mother. The travelers were especially welcomed by those who were ill or failing because of who they were. Healers, and at least one who was acknowledged as among the best of their people. The Ninth Cave had always had a particularly good relationship with the people of Three Rocks, who lived at the place called Summer Camp. Jondalar recalled going there when he was a boy to help harvest the nuts that grew so abundantly in their vicinity. Whoever was invited to help harvest always got a share of the nuts, and they didn't invite everyone, but they always invited the other two caves of Three Rocks and the Ninth Cave. A young woman with light blonde hair and pale skin stepped out of a dwelling that was under the abri and looked at them with surprise. "What are you doing here?" she said, then caught herself.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be so rude. It's just such a surprise to see you here. I wasn't expecting anyone.
Ayla thought she looked sad and drawn. A darkness circled her eyes. Zelandani knew it was the acolyte to the Zelandani of the West holding of the 29th cave.
Don't be sorry, said the first. I know we caught you by surprise. I'm taking Ayla on her first Danyar tour. Let me introduce you.
The first went through an abbreviated version of a formal introduction, then said,
I'm wondering why an acolyte would stay behind. Is someone especially sick here?
Perhaps no more than others here who are close to the next world, but she's my mother,
the acolyte said. Zelandani nodded with understanding.
If you like, we can take a look at her, the one who was first said.
I'd be grateful if you would, but I didn't want to ask. My Zelandani seemed to help her when she was here, and she did give me some instructions. But Mother seems to have gotten worse. She's much more uncomfortable, but I can't seem to help her,
the young acolyte said. Ayla remembered meeting the Zelandani of summer camp the year before. Since each one of the caves of Three Rocks had a Zelandani that lived with them, it had been concluded that if all three had a deciding voice at the meetings of the Zelandania, it would give the 29th cave too much influence. Therefore, a fourth Danyar was chosen to represent the entire group, but she functioned more as a mediator, not only between the three other Zelandani, but also between the three separate leaders, and it took much time and a great deal of skill with people. The other three Danyars were called colleagues. Ayla remembered the Zelandani of summer camp as a middle-aged woman, nearly as fat as the one who was first, but rather than tall, she was quite short and seemed warm and motherly. Her title was Complimentary Zelandani of the West Holding of the 29th Cave, although she was a full Zelandani and accorded the complete respect and status of her position. The young acolyte seemed relieved to have someone else look at her mother, especially someone of such prominence and knowledge, but seeing that Jandalar was just beginning to unpack the things from the pole drag, and Ayla's baby, who was riding her back, seemed to be getting fussy. She said,
You should get yourselves settled in first.
They greeted everyone who was there, put down their sleeping rolls, settled the horses to a good open space of fresh grass, and got Wolf acquainted with the people, or rather, the people familiar with him. Then Zelandani and Ayla approached the young acolyte.
What is it that is troubling your mother? Zelandani asked.
I'm not entirely sure. She complains about stomach aches or cramps, and lately she has no appetite, the young woman said. I can see that she's getting thin, and now she doesn't want to get out of bed. I'm very worried.
That's understandable, Zelandani said. Do you want to come with me to see her, Ayla?
Yes, but let me ask Jandalar to watch Janela first. I just nursed her, so she should be fine.
She took the baby to Jandalar, who was talking to an older man that didn't seem weak or ill. Ayla supposed he was there on behalf of someone else, like the young acolyte. Jandalar was delighted to look after Janela, smiling as he reached for her. Janela smiled back. She liked being with him. Ayla returned to the place where the other two women waited and followed them into a dwelling similar to the ones made by the ninth cave, but this one was much smaller than most of those she had seen. It seemed made to house only the woman who occupied the sleeping place within. It wasn't much bigger than the bed, just a small space around it and a small storage and cooking area. Zelandani alone seemed to fill it with very little extra room for the two younger women.
Mother, mother, the acolyte said, there are some people here to see you.
The woman moaned and opened her eyes, and then opened them wider when she saw the large figure of the first.
Shavola,
she said with a raspy voice.
I'm here, mother, the acolyte said.
Why is the first here? Did you send for her?
No, Mother. She just happened to stop by and said she'd look in on you. Ayla is here, too, Shavola said.
Ayla? Isn't she Jandalar's foreign woman with the animals?
Yes, Mother. She brought them with her. If you feel up to it later, you can go out and see them.
What is your mother's name, Acolyte of the West Holding of the 29th Cave?
Zelandani asked. Vashona of Summer Camp, the West Holding of the 29th Cave. She was born at Reflection Rock before three rocks joined together, the young woman explained, then felt slightly embarrassed, aware that she didn't need to go through so much explanation. This wasn't a formal introduction.
Would you mind if Ayla examined you, Vashona? The first asked. She is a skilled healer. We may not be able to help you, but we'd like to try.
No, the woman said softly, and it seemed with some hesitation.
I wouldn't mind.
Ayla was a little surprised that the first wanted her to look at the woman. Then it occurred to her that the space inside the dwelling was so cramped, the large woman might have some difficulty getting down to the bedside. She knelt down and looked at the woman.
Are you feeling pain now? She asked.
Both Vashona and her daughter suddenly became aware of Ayla's unusual way of speaking, her exotic accent.
Yes.
Will you show me where it is?
It's hard to say. Inside.
Higher up or lower down?
All over.
May I touch you?
The woman looked at her daughter, who looked at Zelandani. She does need to examine her, the first said. Vashona nodded agreement, and Ayla pulled down the cover and opened her clothing, exposing her stomach. She noted immediately that the woman was bloated. She pressed down on her stomach, starting at the top, and working her way down over the rounded bulge. Vashona winced, but didn't cry out. Ayla felt her forehead and around the back of her ears, then bent closer and smelled her breath. Then she sat back on her heels and looked thoughtful.
Do you get a burning pain in your chest, especially after you eat?
Ayla asked.
Yes,
the woman replied with a questioning look.
And does air come out of your mouth with a loud noise in the throat, like when you burp a baby?
Yes, but many people belch, Vashona said.
That's true, but have you spit up blood, too?
Ayla asked. Vashona frowned.
Sometimes, she said.
Have you noticed blood or a dark, sticky mass in your excrement?
Yes,
the woman said, almost in a whisper.
More lately. How did you know?
She knows from her examination of you, Zelandani interjected.
What did you do for your pain?
Ayla asked.
I did what everybody does for pain. I drank willow bark tea, Vashona said.
And do you also drink a lot of peppermint tea?
Ayla said. Both Vashona and Shavona, her acolyte daughter, looked at the stranger with surprise.
It's her favorite tea, Shavona said. Licorice root or anise tea would be better, Ayla said. And no more willow bark either for now. Some people think that since everybody uses it, it can't hurt you. But too much can. It is a medicine, but it's not good for everything and should not be used too frequently.
Can you help her? The acolyte asked.
I think so. I believe I know what is wrong. It's serious, but there are things that can help. I must tell you, though, Ayla added, that it could be something even more serious, which is much harder to treat, although we can at least relieve some of her pain.
Ayla caught the eye of Zelandani, who was nodding slightly with a knowing expression on her face.
What would you suggest for treatment, Ayla? She asked.
She looked thoughtful for a moment, then said,
Anise or licorice root to settle the stomach. I have some dried in my medicine bag. and I think I have dried sweet flag, although it's so sweet it's almost bitter, which can stop cramping spasms, and there are plenty of dandelions around to cleanse her blood and help her insides work better. I just picked some cleavers that can purge her body of residues of wastes, and the decoction of the woodruff I just gathered is good for stomachs. Can help her feel better all over, and tastes good. I may be able to find more of those wood avens rootlets I used for flavoring the other evening. They're especially good for stomach disorders. But what I'd really like to have is celandine. That would be most helpful. It's a good treatment for either one of her possible problems, especially the more serious one.
The young woman looked at Ayla with awe. The first knew she wasn't the summer camp Zelandani's first acolyte. She was still new to the Zelandania and had much to learn, and Ayla could still surprise even the first with the depth of her knowledge. She turned to the young acolyte.
Perhaps you could assist Ayla with the preparation of your mother's medicine. It will be a way for you to learn how to make it after we leave,
Zelandani said.
Oh, yes, I'd like to help, the young woman said, then looked at her mother with tenderness in her eyes. I think this medicine will make you feel much better, mother.
Ayla watched the fire sending flickering sparks up into the night, as though trying to reach their twinkling brethren far up in the sky above. It was dark. The moon was young and had already set. No clouds obscured the dazzling display of stars that were so thick they seemed to be strung together on skeins of light. John Ayla was asleep in her arms. She had finished nursing some time before, but Ayla was comfortable relaxing by the fire holding her. Jandalar was sitting beside her and a little behind, and she leaned into his chest and the arm that had found its way around her. It had been a busy day, and she was tired. There were only 9 people of the cave who had not gone to the summer meeting, 6 who were too sick or weak to make the long walk. She and Zelandani had looked at all 6, and 3 who had stayed behind to care for them. Some of those who couldn't make the journey were nonetheless well enough to help with certain chores like cooking and gathering food. The older man Jandalar had been talking with earlier, who was staying for a while to help, had gone hunting and brought down a deer, so they put together a venison feast for their guests. In the morning, Zelandani took Ayla aside and told her that she had arranged for the young acolyte to show their sacred cave to her.
It isn't very big, but it is very difficult. You may have to crawl through parts of it, so wear something to climb through caves and cover your knees. When I was young, I went into it once, but I don't think I could do it now. I think the 2 of you will manage just fine, but it will be slow going. You are both strong young women, so it shouldn't take too long, but because it is difficult, you might want to consider leaving your baby here.
She paused, then added,
I will watch her, if you like.
Ayla thought she detected a reluctance in Zelandani's voice. Taking care of babies could be tiring, and the first might have other plans.
Why don't I ask Jandalar if he will? He likes to spend time with John Ayla.
The 2 young women started out together, with the young acolyte showing the way.
Should I call you by your full title, a short version of it, or by your name?
Ayla asked, after they had walked a short distance.
Different acolytes seem to have different preferences. What do people call you?
I am Ayla. I know I'm the acolyte of the first, but I still have trouble thinking of myself that way, and Ayla is what everyone calls me. I like it better. My name is the only thing I have left from my real mother, my original people. I don't even know who they were. I don't yet know what I'm going to do when I become a full Zelandani. I know we're supposed to leave our personal names behind, and I hope when the time comes I'll be ready to, but I'm not yet.
Some acolytes are happy to change names. Some would rather not, but it all seems to work out.
I think I'd like you to call me Shavola. It seems more friendly than acolyte. So, please call me Ayla.
They walked further along a trail through a narrow canyon, dense with woods and brush, between two imposing cliffs, one of which held the stone shelter of the people. Wolf suddenly bounded up. He startled Shavola, who wasn't used to wolves appearing suddenly. Ayla grabbed his head between her hands, roughing up his mane, and laughed.
"So you didn't want to be left behind," she said, actually glad to see him. She turned towards the acolyte.
"He always used to follow me everywhere I went, unless I told him not to, until Janela was born. Now he's drawn between us when I am in one place and she is in another. He wants to protect both of us and can't always make up his mind. I thought I'd let him choose this time. I think he must have decided that Jandalar could protect Janela well enough and come to find me."
"Your control over animals is amazing. The way they go where you want and do what you want. One gets used to watching you after a while, but it is still hard to believe," Shavola said.
"Did you always have these animals?"
"No. Winnie was the first, unless you count the rabbit I found when I was a little girl," Ayla said. "He must have gotten away from some predator, but he was hurt and didn't or couldn't run away when I picked him up. Issa was the healer, and I took him back to the cave so she could help him. She was more than surprised and told me that healers were supposed to help people, not animals, but she helped him anyway, maybe to see if she could. I suppose the idea that people could help animals must have stayed with me when I saw the little foal. I didn't realize at first that the animal that fell into my pit trap was a nursing mare, and I don't know why I killed the hyenas that were after her baby, except I hate hyenas. But once I did, I felt that the foal had become my responsibility, that I had to try to raise her. I'm glad I did. She has become my friend."
Shavola was fascinated by the story Ayla told with such casualness, as though it were an ordinary thing.
"Still, you have control over those animals." "I don't know if I would call it that. With Winnie, I was like her mother. I took care of her and fed her, and we came to understand each other. If you find an animal when it is very young and raise it like a child, you can teach her how to behave the same way a mother teaches a child how to behave," Ayla tried to explain. "Racer and Gray are her son and daughter, so I was there when they were born."
"What about the wolf?"
"I set some traps for ermines, and when Deejee, she was my friend, and I went to check them, I discovered that something was stealing them from my snares. When I caught sight of a wolf eating one, it made me angry. I killed her with my sling. Then I saw that she was a nursing mother. I didn't expect it. It was out of season for a wolf to have cubs young enough to still be nursing. So I backtracked her trail to her den. She was a lone wolf, didn't have a pack to help her. And something must have happened to her mate, too. That's why she was stealing from my snares. There was only one puppy left alive, so I took him back with me. We were living with the Mamutoi then, and Wolf was raised with the children of the lion camp. He never knew what it was like to live with wolves. That's why he thinks people are his pack,"
Ayla said.
"All people?" Shavola asked. "No, not all people, although he has gotten used to large crowds. Jandalar and I, and now Janela, of course. Wolves love their young, are his primary pack, but he also counts Marthona and Willemar and Folara among his family. Joharan and Proliva and her children, too.
He accepts people I bring to him to sniff, that I introduce to him as friends, sort of temporary pack members. He ignores everyone else, so long as they offer no harm to those he feels close to, those he considers his pack,
Ayla explained to the avidly interested young woman.
What if someone did try to harm someone that he felt close to? On the journey Jandalar and I made to get here, we met a woman who was evil, who took pleasure in hurting people. She tried to kill me, but Wolf killed her first.
Shavola felt a chill, a rather delicious thrill, like she did when a good storyteller recounted a scary tale. Although she didn't doubt Ayla, she didn't think the acolyte of the first would make up something like that. Nothing like that had ever happened in her life, and it just didn't seem quite real. But there was the wolf, and she knew what wolves could do. As they continued along the trail between the cliffs, they came to an offshoot toward the right that led up to a split in the stone face, an entrance into the cliff. It was a rather steep climb, and when they reached it, they found that a large block of stone partially closed off the way in, but there was an opening on both sides of it. The left side was narrow but passable. The right side was much larger, and it was obvious that people had stayed there before. She saw an old pad on the ground with grass stuffing sticking out where the leather was split on one side. Scattered around it was the familiar debitage of chips and pieces left from someone napping flint to make tools and implements. Bones that someone had chewed on had been thrown at the wall nearby and fallen to the ground at the foot of it. They went inside and walked a ways into the cave. Wolf followed them. Shavola led them to some stones, then slipped off her back frame and propped it up on one.
"It will soon be too dark to see," Shavola said. "It's time to light our torches. We can leave our packs here, but drink some water first."
She started looking into her pack for fire-making material, but Ayla already had her fire-starting kit out, and a small, unwoven, basket-like shape made of dried shreds of bark pushed together. She stuffed it with some of the quick-burning fireweed fluff that she liked to use for tinder. Then she withdrew a piece of iron pyrite, her firestone, with a groove already worn into it from the many times it had been used, and a fragment of flint that Jandalar had shaped to fit the groove. Ayla struck the firestone with the flint and drew off a spark that landed in the flammable fluff. It sent up a faint curl of smoke. Ayla picked up the bark basket and began to blow on the tiny ember, which caused it to flare up in small licks of flame. She blew again, then set the little basket of fire down on the stone. Shavola had two torches ready and lit them from the small fire. Once the torches were burning, Ayla squeezed the bark shreds together and tamped them down to put out the fire so the bark that was left could be used again.
"We have a couple of firestones, but I haven't learned to use them yet," the young acolyte said. "Would you show me how you do that so fast?" "Of course. It just takes some practice," Ayla said. "But now I think you should show me this cave."
As the young woman headed deeper in, Ayla wondered what this sacred place would be like. Some light was coming from the opening that led outside, but without the light from the torches they would not have been able to see their way, and the floor of the cave was very uneven. Pieces of the ceiling had fallen down, and sections of walls had collapsed in. They had to walk very carefully, climbing up and over the stones. Shavola headed for the left wall and then stayed close to it. She stopped where the cave narrowed and seemed to divide into two tunnels. The right side was wide and easy to enter. The other passage on the left side was quite narrow and got smaller. As one looked into it, it appeared to be a dead end.
"This cave is misleading," Shavola said. "The larger opening is on the right, and you might think that would be the way to go, but it leads nowhere.
A little farther along, it divides again, and both ways get smaller and smaller, then just end. Here on the left, the cave gets very narrow and small, but once you get past that, it opens out again. Shavola held up her torch, pointing out a few faint tracings on the left wall. Those were put there to let someone who isn't familiar with this cave know that this is the way to go, if they understand what the markings mean.
That would be someone in the Zelindania, I suppose, Ayla said.
Usually, Shavola said. But youngsters sometimes like to explore caves, and they often work out what the markings mean.
After a short distance, the young woman stopped.
This is a good place to sound your sacred voice, she said. Do you have one yet?
I haven't decided, Ayla said. I've whistled like birds, but I also roared like a lion. Zelindani sings, and it is always beautiful, but when she sang in the mammoth cave, it was unbelievable. What do you do?
I sing too, but not like the first. I'll show you.
Shavola made a very high-pitched sound, then dropped to a low pitch, then continuously increased her pitch until she reached the first sound. The cave sang back a muted echo.
That is remarkable,
Ayla said, then whistled her medley of bird song.
Now that is remarkable, Shavola said. It really sounded like birds. How did you learn to do that?
After I left the clan and before I met Jandalar, I lived in a valley far to the east. I used to feed the birds to entice them to come back, and then started to mimic their calls. Sometimes they would come when I whistled, so I practiced more.
Did you say you could roar like a lion, too?
Ayla smiled.
Yes, and whinny like a horse, and howl like a wolf, and even laugh like a hyena. I started trying to make the sounds of many animals because it was fun and challenging.
And something to do when you are alone, and birds and animals are your only company, she thought, but didn't say out loud. Sometimes she avoided mentioning things, just because it would have required too much explanation.
I know some hunters that can make pretty good animal sounds, especially to entice them closer, like the call of a male red deer and the bawl of an aurochs calf. But I've never heard anyone make a lion roar, Shavola said, looking at her with a hopeful expression.
Ayla smiled, took a deep breath, then faced the cave opening and started with a few preliminary grunts, the way a lion did. Then she let out a roar, like one baby used to make after he reached maturity. It may not have been as loud as the roar of a real lion, but it had all the nuances and intonations and sounded so much like a real lion roar that most people who heard it believed it was real, and therefore believed it was louder than it actually was. Shavola paled for a moment at the sound, and then, when the cave echoed it back, she laughed.
If I had just heard that, I don't think I'd go into that cave. It sounds like there is a cave lion inside.
Just then, Wolf decided to respond to Ayla's lion roar with his own sound and howled his wolf song. The cave resounded that back as well.
Is that Wolf a Zelindani?
The young acolyte asked with surprise.
It sounded like he was using a sacred voice, too. I don't know if he is. To me, he's just a wolf, but the first has made similar comments when he does something like that, Ayla said.
They started into the narrowed space, Shavola first, followed by Ayla, and then Wolf. It wasn't long before Ayla was thinking how glad she was that Zelindani had told her to dress for clambering around in a cave. Not only did the walls of the cave narrow, but the level of the floor rose and the ceiling lowered. It left such a small, cramped space to work their way through, they couldn't even stand upright in it, and in some places they had to get on their knees to go forward. Ayla dropped her torch going through the narrow section, but managed to pick it up before it went out. Progress became easier after the cave passage opened out, especially when they could walk upright again.
Wolf, too, seemed happy to be beyond the tight space, even though he could go